And transportation today, February 19th. We're going to go a little bit out of order because our chair is not here and I don't really want to do work sessions. So we're going to hear from, I'm going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 192. And is Amy Joyce here? You're up first. You want to go ahead and give us what 192 is before we start? Usually we start out with the proponent, but the proponent is delayed, so we'll start out with the opponent. But why don't you give a summation of what this is going to do, please?
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 192 permits Class 1, 2, and 4 all-terrain vehicles to be operated on state and interstate highways under certain conditions, including operating vehicle within boundaries of a county with a population of 20,000 or fewer, meeting the vehicle equipment standards approved by the Oregon Department of Transportation, being authorized by a road authority, posting of signs providing notice of all-terrain vehicles being permitted on portions of highways, and displaying of slow-moving emblem if all-terrain vehicle is not capable of operating at the speed limit or designated speed limit under ORS 810-180, requires all-terrain vehicles operate on highways to fulfill financial responsibility requirements. There is a minimal revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact. There are no amendments.
Amy, it's all yours.
Vice Chair Girard, members of the committee, my name is Amy Joyce from the Oregon Department of Transportation, today representing primarily our Transportation Safety Division. Just as an initial point of clarification, the department has not sought from the governor's office to oppose this bill, but we are here today to raise a number of safety concerns about the features in this bill. To begin with, ATVs are simply not built for on-road use. They are not intended to be on hard surfaces and on-road use. They're meant to be off-road on trails. And that's for a number of reasons. They don't have the types of safety equipment that one would expect on a on-road motor vehicle. They don't have crumple zones. They don't have airbags. Most of them don't have roll bars. And then you have this sort of open configuration, and except for kids under the age of 18, there's no helmet requirement with an ATV. So just baseline, they're manufactured not to be on the road. And in fact, the trade organization for ATV manufacturers and distributors are publicly opposed to legislation and to the use of ATVs on the road, and note a number of reasons for that. I've attached that letter to the testimony that I submitted electronically, and they include in that that letter data about deaths while people are using ATVs, and that half of all deaths occur on the road, in spite of the fact that most states do prohibit use of ATVs on the road. Some other concerns about the bill. This bill would allow use of the ATVs in 9 sparsely populated counties, but on such highways as interstates and federal highways. And so in the counties that would be covered by this bill, we're talking about Interstate 84, US 90, portions of US 97, portions of US 20, and US 26. So those are some high-speed, heavily traveled highways, and there would be concerns there about the ATV users in that context. But also we need to be thinking about the other users of the highway as well, no matter what kind of roadway you're on. It's not just about the interstates, but smaller, less traveled, less high-speed roads as well. There's an aspect of the conflict among users. So like a bicyclist, like a motorcyclist, like a pedestrian, when there's a conflict between a regular passenger motor vehicle or larger motor vehicle and an ATV, regardless of who's at fault, that conflict is going to usually end up with the ATV user and passenger being the loser. And also a big aspect of highway safety is sort of the expectations of all users. We train people how to drive on the road, and there's an element of learning about what to expect from other operators. And when we introduce ATVs, there's an aspect of not knowing what to expect from an ATV rider or an ATV machine. What's the braking distance look like? What's the turning radius look like? What what can we expect from those kinds of operators? And since this is not legal today, it's fair to say that most Oregonians are not going to know what to expect from an ATV rider, just adding a level of concern about the safety in this situation. So those are the concerns of the department, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions?
Got off easy.
Well, you did, Amy.
Thank you.
Is there anybody need the
She's first.
She was first, just because she was from the department.
Okay. So we'll start at the top. Then Ethan Ludwig. John Lane, or I don't know if you want to come up together. That'd be great. Welcome.
Hi. Hello. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ethan Ludwig. I've been riding off-road vehicles or on off-highway vehicles for 35 years. I'm the current president, vice president of the Emerald Trail Riders Association in Eugene, a member of Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association, the American Motorcycle Riders Association. Oregon's off-highway vehicle community would very much like to have the opportunity to ride on some roads. Many OHV trails within a recreation area can be linked together by a short ride on a dirt road that may be restricted to licensed vehicles only. I personally enjoy rides that take all day. Being able to stop in a small town for fuel and food vastly improves the quality of that day's experience. I have been on group rides in Idaho and Utah, where our lunch stop provided a few hundred dollars for that community. There's a growing popularity in Oregon called adventure riding among OHV user groups. This is when you go for a ride on your off-highway vehicle with the intent of traveling a long distance and going on an adventure. The most rewarding adventures are those that incorporate a destination, which may be as simple as a burger and a milkshake, and then heading back. Many adventure riders or credit card their way along, eating at restaurants, staying in hotels at night. Adventure riding is very popular in Mexico, Idaho, Utah, and other areas that have chosen to allow OHVs access to rural communities by being legal to ride on some roads. Some of Oregon's rural communities want to invite OHV recreationalists into their towns, and the OHV community would very much enjoy having access to goods and services. SB 192 seems to have the intent of supporting our rural communities and the 22% of Oregonians who enjoy participating in off-highway vehicle recreation. However, the language of this bill does not support the intent. With the utmost respect to this committee, this bill would have to be rewritten in order to facilitate riding on some rural roadways. Please consider the state's ATV Advisory Committee, the Emerald Trail Riders Association, the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association, and OHV users like myself, resources for legislation related to OHV recreation in the future. You can contact me at any time. I'd be happy to give you my contact information. But right now, we oppose this bill.
Go ahead.
And the question is, what part needs to be rewritten so that you would be for the bill, since most of your testimony was how you like riding and being able to go on highways? What are you opposing that's in the bill?
The restrictions laid out in the language of the bill are not appropriate for off-highway vehicles. As pointed out earlier from the lady from DOT, these are not on-road vehicles and should not be pretend that they are. However, maybe you visited small towns in Idaho, Utah, and even our small towns out in rural Oregon, where the trails get very close to town. Mm-hmm. And currently, you can ride very close, maybe within a few hundred yards of a town, by trail. But then getting into town, you would need to get on the pavement for a little ways. there are towns, or there are multiple examples around the nation where they allow essentially OHVs to be on very low-speed roads if they meet certain basic requirements. So to answer your question, when in reference to the equipment specifications in this bill, the references are to on-road vehicles. If you look at other ordinances or examples that we have, they reference equipment standards based on off-highway vehicles. Okay. So, yeah, does that answer your question?
It did.
Okay.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume, in addition, since I listened very carefully to what you were saying, you don't like the fact that it includes interstate highways?
That's correct. That, again, there are multiple places in Oregon where we can ride on the trails, but you come up, there may be another trail section a mile down a road, and if we could just get on that road legally, we can go to the next trail section. I cannot think of any trails where we want to go down the interstate.
No.
That's
no.
Not the intent of what we would like to see.
Right.
Thank you. Great. Sir, would you allow me to let Senator Farioli testify? He's the sponsor of the bill and needs to get back to work at his other committee.
Senator? Certainly.
Thank you.
I apologize for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senator Ted Farioli, District 30, all are part of 12 counties, 34,000 square miles of God's country. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is not the most pressing issue that members of the legislature will deal with in this legislative session. But I bring this bill as a point of discussion and a point of departure, and I'd like to ask to start with the image of a smart car. And Senator Girard, vice chair of the committee, piloted his Cadillac Escalade up the highway with a group of legislators headed to Margaret Carter's retirement party. And we were paralleled, you know, at 67 miles an hour. Pretty legal, I'd say, on Interstate 5, by a smart car, two and a half of which would have fit quite nicely into the vehicle that we were in. And we were speculating how they came up with the name smart car, because clearly, from my vantage point at that speed, it was not very smart to be on that highway in that motorized roller skate. And I say that with all due prejudice to smart cars. They don't look safe to me. Yet they're a perfectly legal, licensed vehicle, have all the running gear necessary to be called an automobile, although I think you have to put quotes around it, a personal prejudice. And I'm sure you've noticed that anything 50cc or lower will go hurtling past you without regard to lane, whether that is a Vespa or a smaller motorcycle or a scooter or even a motorized skateboard with a suicide switch on that. I think that's a probably aptly named piece of equipment, and those are perfectly legal. I've even seen motorized razors, you know, the little scooter that you can stand on and hurtle down the highway. Not the highway, the roadway. If you scale that up a little bit, lots of towns, particularly resort communities, allow or just turn the other way and look the other way for golf carts that are used on streets and thoroughfares. And obviously, those are not street legal vehicles. They don't have the proper running gear to be licensed. They're not licensed, in fact. And then you could scale up even further and look at motorcycles, which don't have crash curtains, side airbags, seat belts, and a whole bunch of other stuff that, of course, people will wring their hands and say is absolutely necessary for safe travel. Then you can scale up one more time and look at some of these 4x4 ATVs, or four side-by-side ATVs, which are larger than a Volkswagen. They do not have street-legal running gear because the manufacturers, being very leery about liability, put on every one of those vehicles that it's not intended to be used on the street. But the fact of the matter is, as was described by the previous witness, a lot of trail systems end on roadways. And those roadways connect to communities, and very often the main street of that community is a state highway. I'll just point out John Day, Oregon, is bisected north, south, east, and west by Highway 26 and 395. So we're asked to believe that it would be reasonable for people to drive up to Highway 395 but not cross it, or not to be able to track on that Highway 395 to go a few blocks to get to the other side of town. And that's just not reasonable. So I guess if you look at the panoply of vehicles that are out there that people use for conveyance, it's everything from scooters all the way up to smart cars. And a few of them are street legal and licensed as automobiles and motorcycles. Many of them are legal, but not certainly subject to the same standard. The point of this bill is to start a conversation about making them street legal for certain purposes without having to license them as automobiles, or if people want to retrofit them and make them fully operational by all the definitions of an automobile with all the safety equipment, allow for that possibility. I would point out to you that not just a few states have approached this question and resolved it. More than 20 states have some provision for ATVs being used on streets, roadways, and even highways, although none, I think, are legal for interstate commerce, interstate traffic. I would certainly discourage that and wonder mightily about the sanity of a person that would take an ATV on an interstate. But, colleagues, despite all of the hand-wringing about people who have a concern about safety, I would just ask you to use your own common sense and think of the vehicles that you've passed and been passed by that are out there that are perfectly legal, and give an honest comparison with those things and some of the modern ATVs that are being marketed today. And I think you'll see there's no real reason to prohibit the use of ATVs, at least across public highways, and to use them for certain short distances, or to license them within municipal jurisdictions for people to use right alongside of golf cars and other modes of conveyance that we see. And there are no seat belts or airbags on bicycles, colleagues. So thank you for your indulgence. Any questions?
Thank you, Senator. Questions to the senator?
I have one.
Senator.
Good, Senator. You picked the counties with population less than 20,000.
I did.
That was just more or less arbitrary, I would presume, and if we wanted to raise that, you wouldn't be opposed to that.
I would not. The idea that a lot of folks would rather than crank up the pickup truck, a diesel pickup truck, and our multimodal transportation choices are, do I want to take the red pickup or the blue pickup? I would rather just hop on an ATV and take the two-minute drive, to another field. And we can do that currently legally with an ATV if it has an agricultural symbol on the back. So that little orange triangle apparently absolves all of the sins of safety, because we allow people to use their ATVs to cross the highway and to run down the highway, parallel to the highway, or even on the highway if they're engaged in agricultural practices. Do not go after a quart of milk. That would not be legal. So I guess the point I'm making is, Senator Girard, I hope that I've answered your question. If not, toss another one.
Well, I got another one for
yes.
you.
Thank you.
This is kind of a first draft, I would presume.
It is.
And so you did talk about the interstate. The interstate is on this. And
it
some
is.
Of us are having a hard time seeing an ATV go down a four-lane highway.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, I would take that right out of the bill before you pass it.
Well, son of a gun, that's what we were thinking. Okay.
Well, I do know, Senator, that a lot of my district has farms, and you see a lot of those four-wheel ATVs out there. Farmers use them a lot on the roads. I hadn't ever thought about it, but apparently that orange triangle is magic.
It is. It is a great thing to have. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, before I leave, I just wanted to point out that Washington State has taken the action that we're proposing in the last legislative session. So I brought their bill so that you could see what it is that a true democracy and a really free people can enjoy in terms of...
Touché. Thank you very much, Senator. Mr. Lane? I appreciate your indulgence. I apologize for that.
My pleasure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me and other operators of all-terrain vehicles a chance to voice an opinion on Senate Bill 192. My name is John Lane. I'm the vice president of a nonprofit called the Oregon Outback Association, whose goal is to assist backcountry adventurists of all methods by marking key intersections with identifying numbers so that a person can locate their position on maps and navigational devices. I'm also an instructor for the ATV Safety Institute and a master instructor for the Oregon State University's 4-H Youth ATV Training Program. Hmm. We recognize that the intent of this bill is to allow the use of all-terrain vehicles on rural highways. However, as it is written, Senate Bill 192 would require the county or township to post signs on every road they wish to allow open to all-terrain vehicles, effectively closing all existing highways currently open to all-terrain vehicles, at least until they can create and install proper signage. The magnitude of this project and the associated costs would most likely be a net loss to the user. Oregon Statute 801305, it defines what a highway is in Oregon. It's not necessarily paved. And it defines it as, I quote, every public way, road, street, thoroughfare, and place, including bridges, viaducts, and other structures within the boundaries of the state, open, used, or intended for use of the general public for vehicles or vehicular traffic as a matter of right. So that would include gravel, dirt, as long as it's open to the public to use in cars. It is a highway in Oregon. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, that means that every open road, dirt, gravel, or paved, is a highway. That includes many hundreds of miles, if not thousands of miles, in the remote regions of the state that will be affected by this bill. Because of that, we are against the passage of this bill as it is written. Because counties and townships are already passing ordinance to allow ATVs on certain roads within their jurisdictions, we see an opportunity to provide a framework for those counties and towns, but it needs some work first. To reiterate, the current language of SB 192 will not work. We would like to work with you on this. A statewide platform that spells out minimum age requirements, training requirements, and equipment standards are all excellent things to have in a state statute. But they must make sense. Many of the requirements in this bill do not. If done right, the counties and towns can base their ordinance on what the state mandates. They can provide additional restrictions if necessary, the counties, such as which specific roads would remain closed to all-terrain vehicles. The single largest impediment facing those who currently legally operate all-terrain vehicles on Oregon's highways is an unfortunate side effect from ORS 821.200, Section 1, Line F, which says that an all-terrain vehicle and snowmobile cannot cross a highway within 100 feet of an intersecting highway. If the all-terrain vehicle is on a highway, it is technically in an intersecting highway when it comes to an intersection and cannot cross, even if both highways are currently open to all-terrain vehicles. We would very much like to see this fixed and incorporated into this bill if possible. This is another example of an unintended consequence of well-meaning legislation. Law enforcement officers are either unaware of this or have chosen to ignore the statute. The problem arises when a town has opened their roads to all-terrain vehicles, but the vehicles cannot legally cross intersections, especially those of state or federal highways. We're not looking to ride on state or interstate highways. Mainly the issue is to cross them. ORS 821-200 does a good job telling the rider how to cross all highways safely in much the same way as our neighboring states do. We just need to strike that one line out. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, promoting the sensible use of all-terrain vehicles in the remote regions of our state is a tremendous economic benefit to many of those small towns, which rely on tourism to sustain their fuel, food, and lodging industries. It may be possible to correct this bill. If not, it should fail. I repeat, our desire is to help the state write language that makes sense. Again, I thank you for your time and attention to this issue. The Oregon Outback Association is at your disposal.
Thank you very much. If we were to put together a work group, would you be willing to participate?
Absolutely, sir.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Tom Nimala?
Nimala. Thank you, John. Yes, it's Nimala. I've been called much worse, though, so that's okay.
Sorry about that. No problem.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm not referring off of a piece of paper or anything like that, and I'm not used to testimony in front of people with as esteemed.
Don't
as
worry
as
about
as
it.
Okay, so
just tell us what
me.
You want to tell us.
I've been an officer for the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association, which is a statewide sanctioning body since the 80s. I've been I'm still a representative for the National Off-Highway Vehicle Conservation Council, also known as NOVAC, since the 90s, and I've been on the board of directors for years with them, too. with that opportunity, every year we have a conference, and the conference is always in a different state. I've had the conference here, and it was a humongous positive deal. But I've had the opportunity to go to other states and see what they've got, how they allow OHVs, ATVs, and motorbikes, go on public or not, or be directed and whatever. A couple things I wanted to bring up that the other people perhaps haven't is there's back in Virginia, there's a Hatfield and McCoy trail system, and it goes from state to state to state. People get in their side by sides, their ATVs, and they start off in a town and they ride, and there's an established trail system. Sometimes it's connected by roads and so forth. And they come in the next town, they gas up, have lunch, or have dinner, or spend the night in a hotel, and they can go from state to state. In Utah, there's a trail system called the Paiute Trail System that does the same thing. those local communities have really benefited majorly from the tourism and so forth. We would love to have something in Oregon like that. We've already got, I think it's called the Oregon Backcountry Discovery Route, and people take their motorbikes mostly. They take their Jeeps and so forth, and they same deal. It's kind of a off the grid type deal, but some of the scenery is just stellar. I know there's a lot of people that would like to be able to do that on their ATVs, but are unable to. We come out on a road, like John Lane said earlier, just want to go up the road a mile and then catch another road or trail or so forth. And that's all we're interested in, is just to be able to connect up some of these things. Currently, right now, Senate Bill 192, while very well intended, there's some things that we really would like to have changed on there. What John had mentioned earlier about the can't be within 100 feet of a road and so forth. I would love to, if I had the opportunity, I would love to be able to help with this bill, get it redrafted also, if that opportunity arose.
We might give you that opportunity. Questions?
Welcome that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
And Barrett Brown?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Barrett Brown. I'm a lifelong trail rider who grew up with my parents and grandparents recreating on motorized trails in Oregon. I was lucky enough to raise my son riding with his grandparents in the same common bond, the same shared intergenerational interest. I've come today to recommend that you table this bill for further consideration and possible improvement by Oregon's very healthy and active ATV stakeholder community. Organizations such as those facilitated by Oregon Park and Recreation Department, Oregon Department of Forestry, the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association, and most importantly, for consideration by the Oregon ATV Advisory Committee. It's important to say that I'm not suggesting that you as legislators cede your authority to write law to special interest groups or lobbyists. But in this case, after some extremely contentious debates over the years, the legislature created the Oregon ATV Advisory Committee in statute, specifically to help future legislators and others succeed when considering ways to improve safety, sustainability, and a positive future for ATV recreation. And great things have been achieved since then because of that committee. So whether there are ideas that I support or oppose, we prefer to see these concepts come through these stakeholder processes, so by the time they get to you, they're well understood and supported by the community. You've got buy-in and partners. And this process, as you've heard so far, that hasn't quite got there. We want the communities that invite ATV use onto their roads, the road authorities that make these decisions, to capture the full economic benefit potential that exists. And by creating another class of user, we fear a division of these riding groups and families in a way that will really actually get in the way of the economic benefit that this intends to provide. So imagine an ATV riding area in a community currently delivering millions of dollars of economic activity to a county or a municipality, and they want to establish a campground connected by a half a mile of public road. Under this column of equipment requirements, that campground will have to be a segregated class of ATV with this kind of equipment, whereas under current law, the way it is, that community can invite all OHV users to run down that stretch of road. The same thing would happen if a group is to find themselves on a trail coming into a community. They'll have to stop at the road's edge, survey who among them has this long list of Section 2 requirements and who doesn't, and that, you know, half of that group, small children and so on, will have to wait there while the others go and get pizza in a box and gas in a jug and maybe come back to the other group. So we fear it doesn't quite meet its intended purpose. So finally, I mentioned earlier that buy-in. The important way to maximize that economic development opportunity is for that buy-in, self-compliance, and enforceability has to be at front of mind. So, for example, splitting up families in a campground or at the trailhead is going to be problematic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Lots of interest in this. That is the last person that has signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes? Oh, yeah. Come on up. ATVs, Lana? Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here today representing the professional insurance agents. They have the same concerns that the Oregon Department of Transportation voiced in terms of safety, and you would also need to look at the insurance situation. Right now, I don't believe that ATVs are insured as automobiles because they're not allowed on the freeways, on the highways, and so that should be a part of the consideration that you give to this bill. Thank you.
Okay, questions, Alana? Guess not. Anybody else? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 195. We'll take that under advisement, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 272. James.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 272 modifies general powers of Oregon Board of Accountancy and provisions regulating accountants reflecting best practices in state statutes and the Uniform Accountancy Act, updates definition of attest services to restrict non-certified public accountant providers engaging in representation work, the use of language representations that suggest training in and accountability to a CPA profession standard, establishes Oregon Board of Accountancy Fund and State Treasury and continuously appropriates money and funds to board for administration and enforcement of laws regulating accountants, becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. No amendments.
No amendment. Thank you. Martin, I'm not going to try your last name again. Out of respect. This is one committee you'll recall. We heard this one last week, I think it was.
Yeah, I thought there was supposed to be an amendment.
Well, and there's a discussion, and I suspect that we're going to hear about it.
Oh, I heard about that. We're good to go. Glad you remember that.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair, Senator Girard, members of the committee. My name, for the record, again, is Martin Pitioni. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Accountancy. You have before you supplemental written testimony for the record that I sent over to the committee to resolve the issue that was raised at the very tail end of our hearing. We had a very good set of conversations with this very kind gentleman, Ted Hughes, and the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants and other stakeholders to make sure that we were okay with Senate Bill 272 as written. You may recall the issue that was raised was on a peer review language in, I think, Section 17, page 14 of the bill. And basically the issue was that there was a reference that was being taken out to a peer review program that does not exist anymore. The stakeholders raised a little bit of a flag, and we had a good conversation, and the upshot is we all agree, and the board agrees, and specifically basically puts on the record that the bill is permissive, and should they get a peer review program again, that there is nothing in this bill that prevents the board from considering their application for a peer review program. We have, quite frankly, another peer review program already through the Oregon Society of CPAs that the board is currently working with because the language in the statute is permissive. The bill does not change that. So just the same way we are currently able to work with peer review programs that are not specifically referenced in statute, we're not prevented from doing that in the future. And basically the agreement that we reached was is that with this testimony on the record, they're fine with the bill proceeding without an amendment. That's the rough upshot summary. I'm sure you'll get verification if you haven't already on that piece. So I think we're all good.
Thank you. Questions?
Good to go.
No questions. Mr. Hughes, you're okay. Head nod would be fine.
Yes, sir.
We got a head nod. Okay. is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 272? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 272, open a work session on Senate Bill 272. The chair moves Senate Bill 272 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 272 is passed to the Senate floor by unanimous vote of the committee. And Senator Monroe, will you carry? Senator Monroe will carry. Okay, we'll close on 272. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 167. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 167. allows a taxicab driver to use mobile communication device while driving. We do have an amendment on that. The Dash 1 amendment eliminates taxi driver exemption if there is a passenger in the taxicab. There is no revenue impact, and there are no fiscal impacts with Senate Bill 167, the Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Campbell, welcome back. I think we talked about this last year.
It was actually a 2013 legislative session.
Oh, was it 13? Well, yeah. 14. All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Darren Campbell, and I'm the lobbyist for Radio Cab in Portland, Oregon. And, yeah, good memory. In 2013, we brought this through this committee. It got held up on the House side, and that's what the Dash 1 amendment addresses in regards to not allowing this exemption when there is a passenger in the vehicle. There was a lot of concern in regards to drivers that already disobey the law and speak on their phones and scare the passengers in the back seat, which I fully understand. And why don't I step back just a little bit and tell you what the bill does. In 2009, the legislature passed a bill making it illegal for people to utilize a cell phone with certain exemptions. Those were law enforcement, ambulance, tow truck drivers. At that time, the taxi cab lobby was not nearly what it is today, which is still pretty much me. So we were left out of those exemptions, which is what this bill is looking to correct. Right now, 90 to 95% of the people driving taxi cabs are up to date on the high tech and utilizing Bluetooth technology and wireless technology. It's those certain people that haven't gotten up to that technology that we're looking to cover, as well as those times when that technology fails, which it does quite often. And what we're looking for is just the ability to give drivers who are trying to make a living out there the edge to be able to find their customers in hectic situations. You know, downtown Portland on a Saturday night's a perfect example. Trying to find your customers sometimes nearly impossible. So it really goes towards giving better service to the public we're serving. That's why the Dash 1 amendments work very well with this bill, because if you have somebody in the car, you should be working, so you shouldn't be looking for anybody. It's a pretty simple, straightforward bill, so hopefully you'll find it in your heart to move it to the floor just like last session. Yeah.
So I have to ask you, with the most of the cars, and I don't know how modern they are, most of the cars come with wireless now, and for those that don't, with the Bluetooth, it seems like 90% of it are better or already wireless.
As far as the new cars?
Well, even the old ones. If you include the Bluetooth, the earpieces that most of them use, it seems like pretty much everybody is.
And that's what I was addressing when I said 90 to 95% of the people out there have the technology. It's that small percentage of drivers that we're trying to make sure get covered. That and the failure portion, which is actually pretty significant. It happens quite a bit.
Okay. Questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what would be, aside from the failures, okay, the 5% or so who don't have this, what would be the problem with helping them get up to date?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Riley, there is some reluctance. Also, I've spoken to a lot of the people that don't. And either they can't afford it, or you know, some of it is pretty affordable.
That's why I said help.
Yeah. In the world of taxi cabs, where the majority of the opinion is that we work as independent contractors, that can be of some
some
debate.
Some of you do.
Yeah. it's a pretty independent, you know, we pay for everything we have, and the companies typically don't give too much special treatment in those regards.
But you could go back and lobby them to do that.
I certainly could, yeah. I would fail.
Okay. Other questions?
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this bill? I'm trying to find it. I have no one signed up on 167. And do we have all the paperwork for this?
We do.
Well, we will close the public hearing then. We'll open a work session, and perhaps against my better judgment, I will once again move Senate Bill 167 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation, much as we did in 2013. Discussion. Senator Monroe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. driving while talking on a phone is a dangerous activity. Yes. Now, you know, police, fire perhaps, may sometimes need to do that. But a taxi cab driver could simply pull over to the side and make his phone call if he doesn't have the electronic device necessary to make the phone call without a hands-on device. So I cannot support this.
Okay. That's consistent with 2013.
It's consistent with where I've been on this issue for years.
Okay. Anybody else want to jump into this one? Oh, let's just call it.
Senator Monroe?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
No.
Vice Chair Drodd?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Chair Beyer?
Yes. Senate Bill, I have to take that back. We didn't add the amendment.
We did.
Oops.
Okay.
All right. Well, we passed it.
Now what are you going to do?
Senate Bill 167 with the dash one. You'll catch it in the House, would you? It's passed by... 3-2 with this. Let's see. With Senators Riley and Monroe in opposition. I will carry.
Are you going to add the amendment?
No, we'll do it in the House.
We'll do it in the House?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And Darren will have better luck over there. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 167, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 270. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 270. Reallocates money for transportation project listed in Oregon Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009. Declares emergency effective on passage. We do have a dash one amendment. It transfers money between JTA projects reflecting the latest available money estimates from the US 26 at Glencoe Road interchange and I-5 at I-205 interchange at completion. Projects affected by reallocations are reallocates approximately $670,000 from the I-5 to I-205 project to the I-84-257 7th project, reallocates $11 million from US 26 Glencoe to US 26 at Chute, changes the boundaries and name of the US 26 185th to Cornell Road project to the US 26 Cornelius Pass Road to Cornell Road project, reallocates $5 million from the US 26 at Chute Road to the US 26 Cornelius Pass Road to Cornell project, reallocates $6 million from the I-5 at Beltline project to the Beltline at Deltway Highway project, and directs the Oregon Transportation Commission to reallocate any remaining dollars from the US 26 at Chute Road project to US 26 Cornelius Pass Road to Cornell Road project when the US 26 at Chute Road project is complete. And lastly, directs the OTC to reallocate any remaining dollars from the I-5 at Beltway project to the Beltline at Delta Highway project when the I-5 at Beltline project is complete. There is no fiscal impact, and there's no revenue impact for this amendment.
Good enough. This is going to be kind of routine, Paul.
It is, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm not going to go back through the bill again, just as we heard. Really here just to answer questions. Again, we're doing really two different topics here. One, we're cleaning up past actions by this committee that delegated authority to the Transportation Commission, and we're taking the action the commission put in codifying that back into the original legislation. And then the two new things that we're doing is making the changes bridges in the Washington County areas. We can add the additional lanes on Highway 26 out there, Cornelius Pass Road, and then the change in the Eugene area where we're moving funds from I-5 Beltline to I-5 Delta, where we have a better use for the funds. I think I briefed the committee during the interim days. We have the report from our commission that went through that. So unless there's any questions.
Now, again, Paul, this is still all moving the money within the regions where it was originally allocated as agreed to.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's following past practice of keeping things in the region and within the original list of JTA projects. So we haven't gotten and added new projects or we haven't moved money outside the regions.
Great. Questions of Paul? It's kind of the vanilla version of this. Thank you very much.
You.
Paul's the only one who signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 270? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 270. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 270. The chair moves Senate Bill 270 to the floor, right? Not to Ways and Means?
No, to the floor, but with the...
Oh, we have an amendment. Oops, yeah. Excuse me. Let me back up. Chair moves... Boy, I'm scoring today. Take that back. Chair moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 270. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? The dash ones are adopted. Now the chair moves Senate Bill 270 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. Seeing none, is there any opposition? Senate Bill 270 is moved to the, as amended by the dash ones, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Who wants to carry? You want to carry this?
Yeah, I'll do.
Senator Rod will carry. We'll close on Senate Bill 270. Do we have some LCs? We'll open a work session on introduction of committee bills. Again, colleagues and audience, the purpose is to introduce the bills. It is no commitment by any member of support or opposition to the bills that comes later. So they really have four digits?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Senate bills. Huh? All right. Oh, they're LCs. So we will, the chair moves introduction of Legislative Council drafts 2955 related to the travel insurance, LC 3229 related to motor vehicle dealerships, and LC 3230 relating to motor vehicle dealerships. Any discussion on that motion?
A little caveat about how this doesn't it?
I already did that.
Oh.
You weren't listening.
I wasn't listening. I heard the amendment part, though.
The right ear is the bad one.
Sure, anybody wants to vote against this? No. The LCs are introduced. Anything else for the... And we'll close the work session on that. Is there anything else for the good of the order? There is none. We are adjourned.